The Tom Woods Show, episode 1092.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, in 2018, more people than ever are going to be starting up a side hustle online. I know how to do this, and I'll show you step by step exactly what I do in my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income. Grab it over at pathstoincome.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're talking today with Mark Perry. This is not the economist Mark Perry, whom we've had on a couple of times in the past, but rather the foreign policy analyst Mark Perry, who is an author and reporter who has been widely published in publications ranging from The Nation to The Washington Post to The American Conservative. And I want to talk to him about the nuclear posture review that we've just seen come out, within the past week or two, talking about the evolution of nuclear policy in the American military strategy. And that raised a lot of, or set off a lot of alarm bells in a number of communities, certainly in parts of the military, and a lot of commentators are concerned about it. And I thought, if nuclear weapons aren't an important enough topic to talk about on the show, I don't know what is. Mark wrote an article for The American Conservative that got me thinking about this topic, and I'll be linking to that article. He is the author of numerous books, including most recently The Pentagon's Wars, The Military's Undeclared War Against America's Presidents. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
I want to talk about the nuclear posture review of the Trump administration. But first, you have to realize that when it comes to stuff like this, I'm a complete newbie, and I bet the general public sort of is too. Is this the kind of thing that's regularly issued by different presidents, or only when a change in strategy is recommended?
This is standard for every president. The first nuclear posture review was under President Clinton. Then there was one under Bush and one under Obama. It's now become kind of a regular feature of every new administration to review the standing of the nuclear forces and to recommend changes or budget actions. So this was the one that was recently issued last week from the Trump administration is the fourth nuclear posture review.
All right. So first of all, I want to know about what's in this nuclear posture review, and then maybe we might compare it to a previous one to get a sense of how drastic a departure it represents.
Certainly. This nuclear posture review was conducted over a period of about a year by the Pentagon, which charged a number of nuclear thinkers and military officers with assessing the state of our nuclear deterrence. What's new in this review is that it recommends the adoption of low-yield tactical nuclear warheads to our arsenal and the adoption of two new systems, increased spending on our nuclear forces, and a modernization of our triad, that is our bomber, missile, and submarine force. It's quite an extensive document. It was about a year in the making, very controversial, and issued last week.
All right, now let's go through it. First of all, how can we get a sense of what a lower-yield nuclear warhead would be like? What could we compare it to?
Well, the nuclear bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima at the end of World War II, and which killed approximately 80,000 people, was a low-yield weapon, 14 kilotons. So a low-yield nuclear bomb is anything that is usually considered to be smaller than the Hiroshima blast. In our history, there were two systems which fired low-yield weapons, the Davy Crockett, which is kind of a battlefield artillery piece. But to say these are low-yield weapons is kind of tongue-in-cheek. These can kill a lot of people, and they're used on the battlefield to eliminate divisions or corps, 15,000 to 20,000 soldiers. They're not strategic weapons. They don't bust cities, but they can kill a lot of people.
Does the nuclear, we can just call it the NPR, the Nuclear Posture Review, does it lay out what the drafters consider to be the strategic value of these sorts of weapons? I mean, what? So in other words, I hear what you're saying about what it can accomplish, but do they lay out the types of battlefields they might expect to use them on?
Yes, they do, kind of. And I know that's a punt, but the drafters of this nuclear posture review said that the Russians in particular were operating under the mistaken impression that we would not use strategic nuclear weapons, that they would be able to use their own tactical or low-yield weapons to defeat us on the battlefield or to hurt us on the battlefield, and that we wouldn't be able to respond because our only response would be strategic, which would be hundreds of millions or billions of people dead, and we wouldn't do it. So that the drafters of this NPR presumed that our strategic arsenal lacked credibility because we wouldn't use it because we didn't have tactical low-yield weapons. So that's why they proposed the building of tactical nuclear weapons. Now, this is extremely controversial position because the NPR drafters presume that they know what the Russians are thinking. And all of the critics I've talked to on this subject say it's a mistaken impression. We have no idea what the Russians are thinking. This is just sending bad money after bad, that this is absolutely the adoption of a non-essential position and non-essential nuclear weapons, and that it's inherently destabilizing. So it's quite controversial.
Well, even if we could speak non-tongue-in-cheek of low-yield warheads, there is, in, I think, everybody's mind, a sense that there's something qualitatively different about the use of nuclear weapons, no matter what kind they are, and that if defense experts think they could use them in limited ways to go after 15 or 20,000 troops somewhere, surely that's sadly mistaken, because everybody will think that some kind of a watershed has been reached, and it's almost certain to lead to further nuclear escalation. Where am I wrong about that? And I'm just a regular observer here.
Well, as a regular observer, you've put your finger on the real problem. For instance, the Nuclear Posture Review calls for the adoption of a low-yield nuclear bomb put on the warhead of a submarine missile. So, in a time of growing crisis, we would have the option of sending a signal to the Russians, let's presume they would be the adversary, by firing a low-yield weapon. And the Russians would say, oh, that's a low-yield weapon. So we'll respond with our own low-yield weapon, and we will not have an all-out nuclear war. The problem is, when you fire a ballistic missile at your adversary, they have no idea what the warhead is. And they would have to presume that it's strategic, that it would be a hydrogen thermonuclear weapon, and they would respond overwhelmingly, plunging the world into an apocalypse. This is the problem. The problem is that the current NPR presumes we could signal our adversaries selectively, and that they would somehow know the kinds of weapons we're firing when that's not true, and that's a problem. So why have the weapons at all? Why adopt these low-yield nuclear warheads when we don't need them? After all, we already have them in the arsenal, and that's why this NPR is so controversial. It calls for the adoption of weapons we already have. And number two, it presumes the Russians don't view our strategic deterrent as credible, and there's no evidence for that whatsoever. So this is, in the words of one of the atomic scientists I talked to who follows this, this is just bad money. This is just making an expenditure we don't need, and it's very destabilizing.
Well, this report, this review was controversial, of course, even within, or perhaps even especially within, the military community. So I'm curious, in your article that I'm going to link to at, this is episode 1092, so tomwoods.com/1092, you actually go into the weeds a bit as to who exactly is pitted against whom in the struggle over this report. So who's behind it, and who are the people who have been trying to at least limit the damage?
That's an interesting and pertinent question. The Trump administration and Trump himself wanted this, and they appointed Air Force officers in particular to oversee it. And these Air Force officers appointed a committee to draft the report, and then this committee is known as being very conservative. neoconservative, actually. And the appointment of these people to write the report was noticed in the Pentagon, which spurred real opposition to the NPR. Keith Payne, who's a well-known figure in the foreign policy establishment, very conservative, did most of the drafting of this report, along with his colleague, Franklin Miller, who's also very conservative. So it was known immediately when these two were appointed to draft the report, what the report would say, and that it would call for the adoption of these low-yield weapons. What's interesting about the response to this and the opposition to this is that it came from the military. The military thinks that the adoption of low-yield weapons is absolutely unnecessary. And secondly, they're worried that spending the money on nuclear weapons will take money away from the real problems that the military has with readiness, feeding, clothing, training, equipping, and recruiting new soldiers, upgrading and modernizing our conventional arsenal, which critics of the NPR say is really the one deterrent the U.S. has, which is a good military, ready to go, well-trained and recruited, and able to counter moves from our adversaries without the use of nuclear weapons.
Let me read a passage from your article. This is a quotation from somebody else who is in favor of this nuclear posture review. And the quotation runs as follows. This NPR is in line with what three previous presidents have done. Upgrading and modernizing wasn't Trump's idea, it was Obama's. And I understand the problem with funding, and I even agree with it. These budget caps have to go, and if they don't, we're not only not going to be able to implement the NPR, we're not going to be able to address our readiness gap, and that's the truth. The danger here is that in making the choice between one or the other, addressing readiness or building a credible nuclear deterrent, we're in danger of ending up with neither. Now, that I'm curious to get your thoughts on it, and particularly this claim that there's nothing particularly special about this review as opposed to those of previous presidents, including Obama.
Well, it's interesting. That's the defense. That's the defense of the NPR among the class of nuclear thinkers that I was able to access. And they don't like to talk about this because they always have to defend the adoption of new nuclear weapons. And it's that's a red line for many in the military. We have enough, they say, when in fact we have 4,000 strategic weapons. That's more than enough to destroy the world three or four times over. But their argument is that we need nuance in our nuclear posture, and there's nothing wrong with increased numbers of weapons. Increased numbers of weapons, they will argue, makes nuclear war less likely. But that's always been true. And, you know, the point that the critics make, I think, is a salient one. Deterrence has worked, but it can only fail once. And then, really, it is a Holocaust that we're facing. So instead of ratcheting down, you know, the nuclear temperature, taking our forces off of launch on warning, and reducing the number of warheads, and increasing command and control, we're going to do just the opposite. It seems to me to be almost commonsensical, and it seems to me to be that the critics of the NPR will say this, it's very commonsensical that more weapons is not a good idea, that more weapons is not better weapons, and that the way to kind of wrestle the atomic genie back into the bottle is to bring down the threat level, to reduce the number of weapons, and to make nuclear war less, not more likely.
All right, we're going to take a quick break because I have a message that, although not quite as important as nuclear war, I think my listeners will still find valuable. Folks, on tomorrow's episode, I'm going to be talking to Kevin Duffy, who is going to talk to us about the real state of the economy and what the potential pitfalls are. So it could not hurt to be thinking of ways to make yourself a more attractive employee so you're not the one who gets the pink slip. Or frankly, to be building up your side hustle as insurance against that pink slip. And I can think of no better way to do that than through Skillshare, which is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in business, marketing, entrepreneurship, technology, and more. As you know, I am a big believer in lifelong learning, not just about history and economics, but learning things that improve you as a person, as an employee, as a productive individual. Well, Skillshare is going to make it even easier on you because they are offering my listeners a special deal. 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woods. Reading your article, I don't just get the impression, but you actually say that the NPR was in a way dampened down by some of the criticism that people who were opposed to this policy were actually able to make a little bit of headway. In other words, it could have been worse than it was. How?
It could have been a lot worse. It is true that, to kind of go back to your previous question, it is true that previous presidents have always agreed with the need for nuclear weapons, and President Obama actually began the process of modernization of our nuclear arsenal. But that's an extremely expensive proposition, $1.2 trillion over 30 years. The Trump administration has actually added to that cost of $1.2 trillion. It could be now $1.5 trillion. And I think it was the cost of this that really led people in the military, especially in the Navy and the Army, to weigh in. There was a lot of lobbying inside the Pentagon against the NPR. And even the Secretary of Defense at the time, when the nuclear posture review was underway and at the outset, he evidenced real doubts that we should be adopting the programs that the Trump administration's NPR eventually recommended. And you'll still find, I think, a lot of dissent inside the military about this NPR, to the degree that I wonder really how broadly and how deeply it's going to be implemented. I think there's an outside chance that we'll have these recommendations, and perhaps some of them will be adopted, but certainly not all.
Well, that brings me to the question of this claim that Trump was influenced by Sean Hannity, who told him we needed more nuclear weapons, and then Trump went and ordered this review, and we got this kind of review. Is there anything to that? I mean, I can't believe I even have to ask a question like that, but I can't rule out this possibility.
Well, it's broadly believed Sean Hannity went on television and said we needed more and better nuclear weapons. Donald Trump, an avid listener, agreed, called over the Pentagon, talked to James Mattis, and so we have a new nuclear posture review. It's widely believed in the Army that this is what happened. This is the kind of claim that's impossible to prove, but we understand our president and how he's influenced, and this is quite possible.
Just looking, by the way, before we spoke today, I was looking at some commentary on your book, The Pentagon's Wars, which I'd love to have you back on to talk about, because what a provocative subtitle, The Military's Undeclared War Against America's Presidents. I can kind of see a thesis like that as being plausible. I mean, I don't want to be a Pollyanna and think that if the presidents are all wonderful people of goodwill, and if only their intentions could be implemented, the world would be a happier place, because I don't believe that. At the same time, I think it's highly plausible that Obama wanted to, may have in his heart of hearts wanted to disengage in Afghanistan, but could not see a way to make it happen. That's certainly plausible. But in the case of Donald Trump, we have somebody who he wants military officials surrounding him at all times, and he's been more complimentary of the military than almost anybody I can think of. What's the nature of the relationship between Trump and the military?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's one that I think a lot of Americans think about every day. I think it's a mistake for the American public to paint the military with a broad and single brush. These are individual leaders with different political views, as wide and deep and diverse as any among the American people. And so you have on the Joint Chiefs of Staff and among the combatant commanders, different political points of view. And James Mattis is a Democrat. David Goldfein, whom no one knows, the Air Force Chief of Staff, is probably the most articulate an intellectual of any member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff we've ever had, and he thinks innovatively and creatively about foreign policy. I don't think it's a given that our view of the military as very conservative means that they're very pro-Trump. It is true that Mr. Trump gained about 80% of the vote in the military in the recent election. But at the senior officer level, where policies really need to be thought through and implemented, I think it's quite different. There's a real diversity of opinion, and it's not beyond question. I mean, there's no doubt that a military officer will obey the commands of a commander in chief. But I think it's quite likely in the current environment that we'll see what we really haven't seen before, which is not just a yes, sir, and a thrown off salute from military leaders, but a yes, sir, comma, but. Yes, sir, but is an important part of the American military tradition. And the yes, sir, but response to a president has been issued not rarely, but certainly it's not common. But I think we could see more of it in the current environment.
One other thing, what was your impression of Trump's request for a military parade?
I thought it was kind of funny, actually, humorous. I had been reviewing some of my own history readings, and I noticed that General George Gordon Meade, the commander in our American Civil War, the Army of the Potomac, wanted a huge military parade when he was named commander in June of 1863, and his top aide, General, reminded him that a military review isn't going to be possible because General Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, the Confederate Army, was then in Pennsylvania and headed towards Gettysburg. And, you know, military reviews are always kind of were always in American history a kind of a favorite of the military. They love military reviews, especially during our Civil War. But that tradition has faded. And when I heard President Trump call for a military parade, I immediately wondered what the military would do while knowing what they would. They would say, yes, sir, we should do that. But, sir, here's a classic example of the yes, sir, but tradition. Yes, sir, we should do that. But, sir, it'll cost $20 million. We have to bring tanks from all over the world. This isn't the kind of thing we do. We're not sure we can do it very soon. It's the kind of thing that the military would drag its feet on. And frankly, I'd be surprised if we ever saw a military parade.
All right. So there is some sense of cost. With Trump and the military, it seems like this is the one area where he is going to go to bat and get those budget increases come what may. Infrastructure, maybe, but we'll see what comes of that. But when it comes to the military, he doesn't seem to hesitate. And this NPR would, in fact, unless he's going to severely cut elsewhere in the military, it would require, in other words, as you said, you're competing for funds with either basic outfitting of soldiers or these kind of low-yield nuclear weapons. So is he going to be able to get both?
No. We just had passed from the U.S. Congress a huge increase for the military over the next 2 years, and the military applauds that increase. And frankly, we need it. I mean, our Air Force has been in the air since 1991, running constant missions, and they're in need of an upgrade. But what's even more important is that our military is in desperate need of a rest. The reason that we're expending so much money on our military right now is not because the cost of weapons has increased, although that's certainly part of it, but because we're overextended. And you find this, particularly in the Air Force, there's talk of this. They'll say, you know, we need more money for operations, but what would really help us is kind of the ratcheting back of the responsibilities that we've taken on across the rest of the world. We simply cannot continue at this pace. And I think if you sit down with the military and get them to talk to you about what they really, really want, it would be this turning down the temperature on our overseas deployments. We have American soldiers now in Africa and everywhere around the world, and we need to refocus our efforts, bring a lot of these assets home, upgrade them, modernize them, repair them, re-equip them, put on the back burner the NPR and the new low-yield weapons and build a military that we had in the 1980s. That is a strong military that was rarely, rarely used. And I think there's a certain tendency in the military to want to return to those days when, you know, we were feared, but we were feared because we didn't use our military.
Well, Mark Perry, I appreciate your time today. I'm going to, as I say, link people to your article at tomwoods.com/1092, and then tell people to follow you over on Twitter, where you are at MarkPerryDC. And thanks so much again. Maybe I'd love to talk to you about your book at some point, if you can spare me the time.
Absolutely. Let's do it. I'm happy to do it all the time, and I appreciate being on.
Okay. Thanks so much. All right, everybody, that's going to do it. If you're enjoying the show, consider becoming a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. The private Facebook group is just the icing on the cake of all the cool stuff you get over there, but that group is just hopping. And boy, do we have some intense discussions in there, but you're going to love everybody. We'll welcome you with open arms. I know of people in there who have never met a single libertarian before. When we were on the Contra cruise last year, we actually met a couple of people who had never, ever in person, ever met a libertarian. Well, we got a whole bunch of them waiting to become your fast friends. So check it out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.